The industry that's been the worst hit because of the pandemic is the restaurant industry. On this episode of The Ranveer Show, I've brought you the absolute king of the restaurant industry, that's Riyaz Amlani. Known for restaurant chains like Social and Smokehouse Delhi, amongst a host of other restaurant chains. This man's story is inspirational, but this man's present, there's a lot of lessons to learn from it. Even if you aren't building your career in the restaurant industry, I feel like there's a lot you can learn from the trials of another human being, the trials of another business. So this is Riyaz Amlani's business story, as well as how they're tackling this whole COVID pandemic, how the industry has been beaten black and blue, but how they're still climbing out of it, how they're surviving, and how they intend on growing going forward. Fantastic, enriching conversation with Riyaz Amlani. Mr. Riyaz Amlani, how's it going?
It's going swimmingly, Ranveer. How's it going with you?
How does it feel to be one of the most iconic restaurateurs in the country? And I'm saying iconic because when I was in engineering college, I thought, I want to get into entrepreneurship. I love food. I love drinks. Let's combine all of that. Let's try becoming a restaurateur and let's model myself on Mr. Riyaz Amlani. That's how I thought. So how does it feel to be like that right now? Because a lot of young F&B entrepreneurs and just entrepreneurs in general really look up to you.
Thank you, Ranveer. I guess it's a little bizarre because, you know, the timelines in your head kind of get a little twisted. I still think of myself as a challenger rather than the incumbent restaurateur. when I was starting off, we all had our heroes. There was Edi Singh, who was, iconic. There was Rahul Akerkar, who was doing some amazing things. And, just to now share the same room with them used to be, and it still is a treat, you know, and in a sense that we always are inspired by those who came before us.
I'm sure. I want to know everything about your story, but we'll get to that later. I need to ask you about the big question in everyone's heads. There's a lot of businessmen watching this. What is happening in the F&B industry, in the restaurant industry? We all know you guys have taken like a massive hit, and every single entrepreneur in every single industry is looking at the restaurant industry and trying to learn lessons. So can you just take us through what's happened since the beginning of COVID-19 till now? Plus, what are your solutions for this whole situation?
We are in the restaurant business, and a lot of times you have to really question what is the business I am in and what is exactly the restaurant business. Is restaurant business a business of actually feeding people? The first answer would be yes. But if you look a little deeper under the bonnet, it's not really about food, right? It's about the people. It's about the people who are inside your restaurant. It's about how your restaurant makes them feel. It's about how why they have come. Sometimes restaurants are different things. Like some restaurants make you feel elegant and sophisticated. Some restaurants, you just want to go in your flip flops and have a beer. Some restaurants are romantic. Some restaurants are just all about the food. And some restaurants are only about being seen and hobnobbing taking selfies. So it's very different, right? So people usually come to restaurants to actually commune with each other, and you just provide them you provide them real estate for them to actually hang out with each other. So that's really the business we are in. And unfortunately, because what COVID has done, social distancing is the anathema to restaurants. It is the opposite of restaurants in a sense, right? So That is where we are right now. We cannot continue to function as what we intended to be. So when you come up with a restaurant, you take on a really large prime real estate. You spend a lot of money trying to make it look beautiful. You spend a lot of money on the audio. You spend money on the decor. You spend money on the service, the tables, the chairs. And all of these superpowers, all the kryptonite that a restaurateur has suddenly been taken away. So it's a little bit of a jolt to the system. Right? And I guess everybody, including me, is trying to figure out our relevance in the lockdown scenario. Mm. Well, and, you know, we've tried everything. We've tried home delivery. We've tried DIY kits. We've tried, you know, cocktail mixers. And we've done all of that. But we have not set up our infrastructure investments and our superpowers are not about that. We are set up to entertain people. We are set up to be hospitable towards people. We are set up to take care of people when they walk into a restaurant. It's not just about putting food in a bag and sending it to your house. We can do that, of course. And that's primarily one thing to do to, you know, keep in touch with our customers so they don't forget us. So we do delivery so they can get that. If somebody has a craving, they can order. But our primary business is actually hosting people inside our restaurants, which is what, you know, has taken a big beating. And right now we have to understand that it's very tempting to, you know, want to do things and want to pivot and find that magic trick that nobody else has found. But the fact of the matter is we are in the business of hosting people in our spaces, and that's no longer there. So I think you just have to, you know, bide your time, wait for a while, take a deep breath, heal a little bit, because restaurateurs lead extremely stressful lives, take this time, downtime, you know, just recharge your batteries and try and reduce the amount of pain, as much pain as you can, which means that go to your landlords, you know, have a chat with them, tell them, hey, listen, we are in a bad place. How can we work this out? Can you reduce my rents? Can I pay you a little later? Can I preserve this outlet? And if that's not happening, walk away and live to fight another day, you know. But it's a lot of pain for sure. And it's not easy. It's not easy being in the restaurant business right now. But, you know, I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah. To just give the listeners some context, I think you're the founder of so many famous chains, the social chain, is like in almost every Indian city now. Dude, like a lot of people don't know that you're behind it. I'm sure every young Indian has dined or been to one of your restaurants. So actually, could you yourself take us through the whole list super quick, just so the listeners know everything that you're in charge of?
I can tell you that we started our journey with a restaurant called Mocha. It was a coffee shop, and we were serving coffee and dessert. And we famously or infamously started off this whole hookah trend at that point of time. Then the Mocha, then we opened up Saltwater Grill, that became Saltwater Cafe, Smokehouse Deli, which is one of my favorite restaurants, Flea Bazaar Cafe, Ishara, Slink and Bardo, Souffle S'il Vous Plaît. I think that Saltwater Cafe.
Right.
And social, of course, yeah.
So Smokehouse Deli has been a personal favorite of my mom and me for years now. Like, it's kind of a happy place. Yeah, and either way, coming back to the conversation, while I understand it's hard, I just want you to separate like the entrepreneur Riaz from yourself and just think of the guy Riaz. Dude, when all this started happening back in March, when the lockdown started becoming a reality, I remember I was really scared because I'm like, dude, I have a team of 10 video professionals. How the fuck are we going to like operate, you know, remotely? I can't imagine what you went through. So what did the man Riaz go through, dude? Like, what were you thinking?
It was a nightmare, and I kept wanting to wake up from it, to be honest. And it's, and it, you know, a part of it hasn't really sunk in still, you know. Like I said earlier, suddenly all your superpowers are taken away from you one day, and it's hard to come to terms with it, right? Of course, our first thought was, you know, what will happen to my business and what will happen to my family? But that quickly made way to what will happen to my people, because it was I was seeing on a daily basis, even they were going through a lot of pain and insecurity and anxiety. And I had no answers for them because I didn't know myself what I could do. It was all very new. We were all trying to figure it out. When we first went into lock-in, we thought it would be for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks and we'd all come out. It seemed like a lifetime, you know. How will we pay the rent? How will we pay our people? How will we pay our suppliers? All of that stress. It was very, very stressful. But I guess, it came down to me then realizing that it's okay not to have all the answers. it's okay to, you know, not know the next course of action, because you're so used to being the guy who, you know, has all the answers and will get everybody across. But this time I just had no option but to, you know, just round up all my people and have a chat with them face to face. I mean, we did a lot of Zoom conferences. We've got, when we shut down, we had about 3,900 people working for Impresario directly. So it was really horrible, but, you know, I just try to tell people as honestly and plainly as possible that, look, you know, as of now, you know, I can't really do much. When things get better, I'll take all of you back. But right now, I can't do much for you guys. And I think people appreciated the honesty, and it was horrible to be the bearer of such terrible news. But I think the support and the love I got from my people was really, really heartwarming and gave me a lot of strength. And also led me to believe that the business is not about one person or two people. It's about the entire family who make it up. So it was in a sense a life-changing lesson for me also. To realize that it's not about me doing things for them, but it was about they doing things for me.
Right.
So it was quite a life-changing lesson for me.
Yeah, brother, I totally relate to that burden of entrepreneurship. Like, I think I've just been running these things for 4 or 5 years now, and I feel a very intense burden already. And keeping in mind just the scale of which your business is, I can't imagine what you're going through in terms of lifting that weight on your shoulders. So,
I was carrying that weight around until my people took it from me. You know,
okay.
And that was the most beautiful part. I mean, entrepreneurship can seem like a burden, but it's also a privilege.
What do you mean?
The fact is that, you know, I mean, you're the guy who can't check out, right? You're the guy who can't quit. You're the guy who can't just say, hey, you know, bahut ho gaya, I'm resigning. You know, you started this and you have to finish it, in a sense. You're riding a tiger. So in that sense, it feels like a burden, but it is also a privilege to be able to create something, to actually, you know, dream of something and be able to kind of see it materialize in front of your eyes and then to actually have it, right? So I think that's also a privilege. And it's one of those things that, you know, a lot of people dream of being entrepreneurs, but, you know, A, don't find something that they want to spend the rest of their lives doing. They never know. And those guys who find it, don't find themselves not in a position to do what they want to do because they've got other responsibilities. Maybe they're not in a financial position to do that. Maybe they don't know how to do it. I think the third part of this jigsaw is actually having the talent and the passion for the thing that you think you love doing. Right. So I think that all these things, when they come together, that is a position of tremendous privilege.
Right.
Because you're blessed. You're blessed.
I hate being the guy who takes this conversation to a negative place again. But again, this is just to give the viewers context. So the restaurant business primarily kind of loses money in rent and in salaries, like off the staff. So I know, like, I'm sure, you know, you're bleeding out in a big way right now because of the circumstances. But in terms of business again, how are you managing the finances? Like, how are you pulling in money to kind of make up for the money that's going out? Because the money that's going out, I'm sure it's in some massive amount, whatever, lakhs, crores. But what are you doing to, like, you know, inject it back into the system right now?
Well, you know, honestly speaking, there's nothing much we can do right now. I mean, the only way of getting some degree of liquidity for the restaurant business right now is either debt or raising equity, right? Either way, both these scenarios are really, really difficult. I mean, of course, you can do, you know, catering or, you know, cater to some institutions like doctors who need some kind of, you know, food sent, or people in home quarantines need food sent, or people in home, you do home deliveries and encourage that. But that doesn't really pay the bills, so to speak, right? That just covers part of the expense. And sometimes doing this business in this kind of a scenario, you actually end up losing more money than you make.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it's a way of keeping in touch. But right now, I think the only way of really doing it is to try and raise some degree of liquidity through the debt or the equity markets and really conserve as much cash as you can. Like, you live to fight another day. That means taking some really hard decisions. You know, sometimes you have to have the discipline of being able to walk out of your property. Because bleeding money and not knowing, you know, you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, that could be even worse. So we've been taking some really hard decisions every day, you know, letting go people, letting go outlets, kind of, it's almost a creative destruction of everything that you built over the last 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's dismantling everything, trying to make sure you minimize the damage. It's been crazy. I mean, we tried to find jobs for the people who are working for me in other companies. So like online grocery companies were doing really well. Delivery companies were doing well. So, you know, trying to take my people and then almost give it to other companies. I mean, it is hard, but I think that, you know, we'll bounce back, because I think it's important, Ranveer, to think in years now and not in months. Mm. Right? How long will this pandemic last? You know, anybody's guess is as good as mine. We don't know when we will see the peak, when we will recover. But we have to understand this too will end at some point. Yes. And people will want to, you know, come back, and they'll, you know, I'm always wondering who's the first person I want to have a drink with, who's the first person I want to have coffee with, yeah. You know, who do I want to go and meet first, right? Yeah. And that sweet anticipation is still there, and I think it'll come back.
Yeah.
And we just have to make sure that we survive till the point we get there. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, speaking as a Punjabi who enjoys the good life, that's exactly what I believe. I think there's going to be a massive bounce back in the hospitality industry. Lots of people are waiting to get out. But also, again, like, if I had to just take all experiences from these 4 months, what's been your one big life lesson? Just one life lesson.
Sometimes, you tend to get very wrapped up in your own identity, in your own head, right? There was a guy who was Riaz before he became a restaurateur. You know, I'm actually quite shy and introverted, and I love being a homebody and reading books. And I'd forgotten about that guy for a very long time, because, you know, as a restaurateur, you have to have a certain persona. You have to be gregarious. You have to be outgoing. You have to be a man about town. So, you know, while living that life, I forgot about the guy who was really, you know, more quiet, more resident. So I think that it's nice to be acquainted with myself again. It's nice to spend so much quality time with my children and my wife, and, you know, build stronger bonds with them. Slowed down a little bit. And, you know, I was so stressed out. There was this constant state of low-level stress when you're a restaurateur, because there's always something going wrong or just about to go wrong, or there were like 20 different things that exploded in your face. And you know, especially on Saturdays and weekends, it's always more stressful. You really don't have too much downtime. So I think that one good thing is that, you know, I've taken this kind of moment to pause and reset and recalibrate myself. So on a personal level, I've never been happier. But on a business level, you know, things are really, really shit.
You grew up as an introvert?
When I was growing up, I didn't have that many friends. I was painfully shy. I was always slightly overweight. So I was always, you know, being teased, this, that. So I was always a little socially awkward, always uncertain whether, you know, I'm welcome there or not. So my best friends were books. I spent a lot of time reading. I think it took a while for me to, you know, I think that really helped me kind of gain a lot more confidence in myself. It went from being shy. I still am a little shy, but I have to now suddenly put on this suit where I am.
Yeah, dude. With restaurateurs, the word you usually associate is flamboyance. Like, you know, so when you're saying that you're shy, I don't completely understand how you broke through that shell. So that's exactly where I want to begin your story. Like, we'll talk about how you built out the business. But that first eggshell that you broke, which is that, how did you go from being shy to becoming that guy who says, okay, I'm going to talk to people, I'm going to get shit done. How did that happen? Like, did you tell yourself something? Did you practice some kind of I don't know, personality development technique? Like, what happened?
Well, spending time with a lot of books does transform you into a slightly more articulate, well-read, you know, person. So that does give you a sudden sense of more confidence in, you know, yourself, of course. And before I got into the restaurant business, I was a shoe salesman.
Oh, wow.
And I think being a salesman is really something, you know, which gives you a lot of insight into people. And how do you actually kind of ingratiate yourself with people? And how do you get them to trust you in a very small period of time? And how can you, you know, make them feel better about themselves? So I learned that while I was selling shoes. And I remember I was pretty young when I started off as a shoe salesman. I was 14 or 15. And I used to say, "Auntie, these shoes look so lovely on you." And, you know, I used to make a sale, man, and I used to make good sales and good commissions. So that gave me a lot more confidence. So I went from being shy to arrogant very quickly. the brashness of youth, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's all of us, bro. Like, again, I was having this conversation with this other entrepreneur friend of mine yesterday, and he said something really cool. He said that everything in life, once you're an entrepreneur, everything in life is sales. Whether that is actually selling your product or even marketing yourself. Like, if you're a single guy like myself, if you go to a party, I'm not saying I'm trying to patao anyone, but you have to kind of project yourself in a certain way. And even that is its own form of sales. You're selling yourself. So, which brings me back to the books. You spoke about some books that gave you strength, that gave you confidence. Could you name some of them? Like, some books that actually had an impact on you when you were younger?
Some books that had impact on me when I was younger. You know, you grow up, I mean, there's a particular hierarchy of reading books. You know, you go from your Secret Sevens to Famous Eyes. I don't really know if people know what those are anymore. Mm-hmm.
Enid Blyton, man.
Louis L'Amour's and then Sidney Sheldon's, and then you kind of go from there, right? So I was really a fan of well-written literature. So, you know, books like Unbearable Lightness of Being, The Fountainhead, those are all the cliched books, right, that everybody's read and kind of... Yeah.
But what do you gain from fiction? Like, I'm just asking out of curiosity.
Well, what you can gain from fiction is, I think, while, you know, it's really, I mean, you can read a lot of these kind of business books. But you have to understand that all of these business books are nothing but one big marketing spiel, right? And they don't really give you the unbridled truth. But when you read fiction, I think it gives you a window into another life, another time, another space, in a sense. And I think the ability to kind of string together words use them well. Salman Rushdie does that really well. With great effect. Ben Okri, again, one of my favorite authors. They just, the way they actually use words as a mean of communication, and not just communication, but also means of basically connection, right? Mm. It's really, really special. And I'm rediscovering the joy of reading again, which again, you know, I mean, reading something which is not on a screen is great. I'm enjoying that. So books are, you know, they're just friends that you never leave you, you know, they stay on your shelf.
Yeah. You become the books you read, as they say. And at least from what I've gained from this chat with you is that I felt like you learned, I mean, it sounds bad, but I felt like you learned sentence construction, and somewhere that translated into sales when you match it with your own internal business acumen. Am I right?
Well, you know, I'm not a big seller about, like, when it comes to myself. Like, I'm still very shy, and I don't really kind of, I'm not very good with social media. I'm not very good at putting myself out there, you know, on a day-to-day basis. But I'm very passionate about the things I build. And that's something I really like to share. So for me, it's more, I mean, I get, you know, like when some entrepreneurs who especially entrepreneurs who are leading the company, like, for example, Richard Branson, he is the brand, right? Elon Musk, he is the brand. But there are also entrepreneurs who are not really, you know, putting themselves forward, but more about the product. I think I'm in the latter category, not really kind of the guy who likes to lead that particular lifestyle, has to be a particular way. In a sense, I'm not that guy. So I actually kind of, my private life is very, very quiet and downtime and relaxed. But when I'm entertaining, I've got to be the guy. I've got to be the pipe.
So when we're speaking about the things you built, I want to go back to Mocha, your first restaurant. How do you start from one establishment and then build out so much? And also, in what year was that? Because I remember Mocha coming up in Bombay when I was a teenager. So like 2005, 2006, I'm guessing?
2001, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. So that's like almost 20 years you've been doing this.
Yeah, two decades.
What's the story? What happened in 1999 that got you thinking about, I want to become that guy in 20 years?
You know, when I started off my career as a shoe salesman, my big dream was to have my own shoe shop, which I did. You know, I had my own little shoe shop, which I ran for 5 or 6 years. And one of the things that, while I was doing that, I was dating somebody. And you know, I found that in Bombay, you never really had entertainment. You really couldn't do much if you were, if you wanted to kind of commune with your city, besides going up and down on Marine Drive or Worli Sea Face. You know, there was really at that point of time, not much to do by means of entertainment. So I thought Bombay needs to have something where people can just go and hang out and do stuff. So I got into the family entertainment centers, which is basically bowling alleys, go-karting tracks. I was helping consulting, developers to set up those things. And what I noticed was people used to come for these activities, but no matter what happened, whether they went bowling or not, whether they went bumping, into the bumping car or not, they would definitely grab a cup of coffee and a sandwich and take the time to actually hang out with each other. So, and slowly, slowly, I used to just put a coffee machine and some stale sandwiches over there. And that was now, but slowly, slowly, I started enjoying that part of the business a lot more than just the bowling and the bumping cars. And in my head, I thought that people just needed a space to hang out with each other. And it might appear strange, but for people now, but if at all you wanted to go to a restaurant at, let's say, 5 p.m. and hang out, you couldn't go anywhere. You either went to a 5-star coffee shop, which is open 24 hours, or you went into a ODP restaurant to have idli. And there was nothing in the middle, right? So all the restaurants were open only from 12 to 3, and then from 7 to 10 in the evenings. And you never really had an all-day space to really hang out. So that's how Mocha really came about. And, Starbucks was very popular in the West. It had become all the rage. We wanted to do something like a coffee shop, but we didn't want to do a rip-off, right? So we wanted to create our own little space where people and create an atmosphere conducive for conversation. So we built Mocha around a Middle Eastern coffee shop, which was, kawakhanas of Turkey and Morocco, where people used to gather around coffee and a hookah and, chat the evening away or chat the afternoon away. So that was the real inspiration. And I honestly didn't know anything about restauranting. Zero. Not a bupkis. Nothing. I just found some really great coffee from all over the world. And I used to buy desserts from other people and sell it in my restaurant. So it was just that. I was selling, coffee was easy to make. And desserts were coming from outside. So it just started from that. So, and then when I did that, and one of the things that me and two of my friends came together to do this business, Varun and Kiran, and we kind of ran out of money halfway through the project. We didn't have money for furniture. So we bought furniture from wherever we could. And a very famous legend goes from a watchman's stool, which is still in my office. We put it inside the restaurant and all this mixed match. And I think that's what really caught the attention of people. And even we were very surprised by how well it was doing, Mocha. And then I think one thing led to another. So we started off our company with an investment of 15 lakhs, 5 lakh rupees each, me and two of my friends. And since that day, one thing has led to another and here we are.
Can I take you back to that young version of Riaz? And if you're comfortable like talking about it early on in your first 2-3 years, what kind of money was ending up in your pocket from just that one restaurant?
You know, we got greedy pretty quickly. So while we set up the first restaurant, like I said, we ran out of money. 15 lakhs was clearly not enough. But we got greedy pretty quickly and we said, you know what, this is doing really well. We should open up a lot more. And so then we started our first one in Churchgate and we took on this property in Bandra again with, you know, no money in our pocket, thinking that now money is starting to roll. We are, you know, like we are doing 15 lakhs of sale. We are saving 2 lakh rupees a month. That's a lot of money at that point of time. So, you know, we're going to now invest that money in another restaurant. So while we had a lot of cash flow coming in, we were not really blowing it all up. We were reinvesting it. So we bootstrapped our way pretty much for 5 or 6 years before we started, you know, leading a fancier lifestyle.
That's good advice, honestly, for all entrepreneurs, where I feel that, like, you know, young entrepreneurs nowadays in startups, when they raise money, a lot of them kind of eat away a big chunk of money in terms of their own salaries. But that whole profit and loss game is really it's a very basic lesson, but it's something that a whole generation doesn't pay enough attention to. Also, like, I want to ask you again. So cool, like, you did Mocha for a while. You opened up outlets. What gave you the guts to open, say, like a new brand? What was in your head? Was it, again, that whole thing of, okay, we did it once, let's replicate the formula? Was it trying to capture a larger market? What was going on in your head?
You know, when we started a Mocha, that's all we wanted to do. We just, when I did my first Mocha, I thought I'll grow old, you know, be that old uncle behind the galla. and be that guy. And I had no ambitions of having a chain. But after it became successful, right, we got a little greedy and said, okay, now we will have 100 mochas in the country. Mm. It never happened.
That happened with social. That happened with social, though.
We still not 100. But we came across this beautiful piece of property on a beach on Chaupati. And it was available. And they said, why don't you do a Mocha over there? And we said, look, you can't do a coffee shop because you need the whole day to run. The economics don't work. So we actually created a restaurant called Saltwater Grill, which was only about that space, right? It was called Saltwater because it was by the ocean. And also the two most basic ingredients of cooking is salt and water. So and we really created that space for that space, right? And I often, like, for me, a good restaurant, you know, is always bespoke. It's all very nice to have a chain, but sometimes when you come across a really interesting property, you want to build your restaurant around the property and not build the property around your restaurant.
Right.
And I think that that's a big difference. And each space is unique, you know. So I think that you kind of have to marry the concept and the space really, really nicely.
Yeah.
And it's very, very important.
I think that's what you guys have strongly followed with the social chain of restaurants. Okay, and I'm going to give you a perspective of a kid who's gone to social right from college. So I remember you guys started Colaba Social first, if I'm not mistaken, and it was a rage and it had a very Bombay vibe. Plus, it was next to the Gateway of India. And then I remember going to, I think the next one was Bandra or Versova, one of them. And it felt completely different. All right. But my real business learning came when I went to Chandigarh and Delhi and I saw your socials there, and you had a different menu, you had a different, like, kind of look and feel, and I realized that you're trying to mimic what Chandigarh is, you're trying to mimic what Delhi is. I dived a little bit deeper and I found out that you've hired teams from Delhi for the Delhi restaurant who understand Delhi really well, who are able to paint the vibe of Delhi inside the restaurant. And there's actually a really strong branding lesson there for all businessmen. It's exactly what you said, that, you know, if you start a business out of Bombay, it's very likely that your first customers will come from Bombay, and someone from Delhi may not appeal as much. If you grow it out on a national level, Indians will love your restaurant, but maybe the Japanese won't. So wherever you start your business, your target market is always around you. It's a great branding lesson. But again, like, was this something you thought of consciously? How did that thing happen?
You know, when you build, we were very clear that social was a kind of community space for that particular community. And one of the most beautiful things about India is that it is so not homogenous. it is so varied. Unlike the West, you know, where you know the same burger works in the West Coast and the Bible Belt and in the East Coast, right? In India, it is very, very different. We have so many nuances. Like there's a huge South Bombay, North Bombay divide. You know, there's a whole West Bombay, Central Line Bombay divide. You know, and when we were doing Mocha, one of the things that I really enjoyed was getting to understand how each city was slightly different. And, you know, how those people were slightly different. And
Can you take us to a few of those lessons, like that each city being different?
Okay. So, for example, let me, like Bombay, for example, right? Bombay is not in your face. You have to kind of discover Bombay, right? In a sense that in Delhi, you have Connaught Place, you have Vasant Kunj, you have Cyber Hub, you have all these little grand boulevards, you have Horse Cars Village, you have all these little spots. Like Bombay is more punctuated, it's more spread out. You have to go into the by lanes to discover Bombay, right? It's not about the hubs and everything is then concentrated in the hubs, because Bombay is all about niche dukaan upar makan, whereas Delhi is all about, you know, ye residential colony, no commercial activity, it's all got to be, you know, in that market. And it's got that little flavor, right? Even in, when it comes to their flavor profile, right? People in Delhi love spicy food. People in the south of India love spicy food. People in Bombay, because of the Gujarati influence, maybe like their food a little sweeter.
Wow. Right?
They like a little sweet in their flavor. So, but the Delhi spice is very different from the Bangalore spice, because Delhi spice is all about the red chili spice. Bangalore spice is all about the green chili and the pepper spice. So, you know, I mean, it's still different, right? And you, when you enter into a city and you want to be relevant to that community, you really need to be respectful of that community. And in a sense, you know, pay homage to that community and try and, each person's nostalgia is different, right?
Mm.
And nostalgia is actually a great feeling. It brings out something in you that you like to connect with. So, the nostalgia of people in Delhi is all about Nirulas, for example, right? They grow up eating the chocolate fudge over there.
Mm.
And Bombay is all about the pav bhaji and the vada pav. Right? What those triggers of those nostalgia are different in different cities. And, you know, you have to dig a little deeper. And that also is the most rewarding part of the business, because you get to discover so much, you get to learn so much, and that expands your horizons a lot more.
Right.
So the most fun is, like, even for Smokehouse Delhi, right? We love doing that because the walls are illustrated museums of that particular community, right? So Smokehouse Bandra is about those little Goan villages that used to exist in Bandra, the Bandra villages that used to exist. And FIFC, Bandra Kudla, is all about money and monopoly and stuff like that. So, It's really nice kind of looking a little deeper under the skin of where you are as a location and being respectful of that, I think.
Do you collect all this data anywhere? Like, do you kind of have a dossier or something where you write down that, okay, more spicy food for Delhi and Bangalore, sweeter food for Bombay? Or is this just from your instinct?
We know I actually, unfortunately, I'm a horrible documenter of things. It's all here and here. So, but, you know, as the company grows larger, the importance of, you know, communicating and writing things down and, you know, preserving that is becoming more and more essential. Mm. But no, I'm not one of those, 100-page SOP type guys, no.
Okay, so you started with Mocha, social happened, Smokehouse Delhi happened. How do you expand teams? How do you go from three guys running one restaurant into this big conglomerate, like this big kind of corporate company? How do you transform into that? Are you mentored by someone? Do investors come on board and help you? How do you scale up?
All of that, actually. You know, you start off and you stumble your way along your journey, you know, and you have ups and downs and you have mistakes. And then, you know, I've had... if you can find mentors, please, you know, get mentors. If you can surround yourself with people who will support and guide you and handhold you through your journey, please do get them, right? But at the same time, I a lot of times people come to me and ask me, should I do this or should I do that? I always tell them that my advice is not my advice, because, you know, it is true, because I when I had this idea for a coffee shop, I thought the prudent thing to do would be to go to a lot of people and ask them what they thought. And they always said, nahi beta, ye idea nahi chalega, you know, kyunki tumko malum hai kitna coffee bechna padega tumko. कितने गर्मी का मौसम है, कोई नहीं आए कॉफी पिएगा, हम लोग चाय पीते हैं, यू नो, एंड देन इट वर्क्ड, राइट? एंड मेनी टाइम्स पीपल कम टू मी एंड दे से आई वांट टू डू अ जूस बार, आई वांट टू डू अ माइक्रो ग्रीन सैलेड बार, एंड आई एम लाइक, यार सैलेड कोई नहीं खाता यार, यू नो, सब लोग को चिकन मटन चाहिए, तीखा मीठा चाहिए. And then I realized that I have become the same guy who was telling me, you know, don't do it, like 20 years ago. And so it's very easy to get caught up and you get high on your own supply, you know, in the sense that, you know, today's beasts will be tomorrow's dinosaurs. And it's just the way it is, and it moves on, right? So I try not to keep my trap shut when it comes to advice, and say that, look, it's okay to take people's, you know what, Henry Ford famously said, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they said faster horses when he built them cars, right? So I think it's, you have to just go with that little voice inside you that is nagging you all the time, doesn't let you sleep, you know, captures all your waking moments. And you got to listen to that guy more than you got to listen to everybody else around.
100%. Like always follow your gut. But I have like two burning questions in my head right now. The first question is, why did y'all expand so much? Like, y'all expanded like a lot, dude. Like, I'm sure you looked at Bangalore, Chandigarh, Delhi. You could have just stopped at running a really successful chain of restaurants in Bombay. So what's the core of you co-founders thinking? Like, why did y'all want to expand so much? Like, what is the end goal?
You know, three reasons, I suppose. Initially, it was ego. Look at, we are building an empire. I think that very quickly made way for the need to share the love, you know, in the sense that you wanted to kind of embrace more people. That was, you know, when you were still younger, more passionate and, you know, saying, you know, oh, you don't have a mocha in your city. You know, you guys need to have a mocha in your city. We're going to find a way to bring mocha in your city. So I think eventually that it what we realized that if we did not grow, people would leave us, right? And we didn't want people to leave at all. And so we started growing so that we could give people growth. Like if the company is stagnant, you can't really give anybody growth, because after some time, there's going to be, people are going to come to a top and then they're going to get itchy feet. So this kind of forward momentum was propelled first by ego, then by love, and then by the people, I think.
Yeah. That's the other curse of entrepreneurship. Like, if you really want to hold on to the best talent, you have to kind of work even towards their dreams, not just yours.
Yeah. Of course, you in fact, and it's beautiful, because I think that both your dreams drive both of you forward.
100%. And
I think they both, it's symbiotic in that sense.
I'm going to talk about this thing that happens to me sometimes. So I'm deeply spiritual, deeply God-fearing, always been. That's how I've been brought up. And it's been kind of an anchor point for me through my career, the entrepreneurship journey. There are many moments where in deep meditations, in deep prayer, I let out tears of entrepreneurship. That's what I call it. Where you feel a certain burden of leadership. You feel exactly what you said, that this pressure of your people's dreams as well kind of placed on you. So I kind of cry out my pressure. Do you have moments like that? I'm not saying do you cry. I'm saying do you kind of let it out somehow?
My wife keeps telling me that I'm very internal and I don't let out my... I bottle up a lot of my things. But I know that, you know, sometimes it can, it can get very lonesome.
Yeah. Lonely at the top. That's what
we can,
like.
But you know, I think one of the things that I really enjoyed was my time serving with the National Restaurant Association of India, which I led for a bit. It was really great because, you know, I could, yeah, there's so many people who are going through the same stuff like me. Like, our best friends couldn't understand what we were going through. But, you know, as another restaurateur, because, you know, the conditions are so horrible, the hours are terrible, you know, the police thinks you're a criminal, the politicians think you're a criminal, the bureaucracy thinks you're a criminal, and you're treated almost like one, and then you work so hard, and it's a high-risk business, and there's very little reward. I mean, it's glamorous, but honestly, you'd make more money selling ball bearings. Right?
Wow.
So it is, so, but having, you know, a peer group, in a sense, you know, really, really helped. I mean, some of my best friends now are my direct competition. You know, people like Priyank and Rahul and Zorawar and Kabir. These guys, you know, Rachel, these are all very, very good friends of mine. And they're all restaurateurs. And I find myself, you know, even after work, hanging out with them or going over to their house when I'm in Delhi or going over to a restaurateur's house in Bangalore. And even the very fact of actually discussing your craft, you know, with another person who understands the nuances of your craft, you know, I think that actually takes away the loneliness and it makes it a lot more fun. So I actually consort a lot with the enemy and now they're my best friends.
I think that's the case with YouTubers and social media stars as well. Right before this conversation, we were talking about how you were kind of seeing online hate as a subject that's come up during COVID-19. We kind of shed that off ourselves by talking to each other about it. So I completely relate.
Yeah, great. You know, and it's also like this kind of, this almost rivalry, but it also propels you forward, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't hold you. I mean, you know, there's always going to be that one guy who irritates you so much that you want to prove him wrong, right? But at the same time, there's going to be admiration.
Yeah.
And respect, because, you know, they understand how difficult it is to get so much love and so much following and to be relevant to people and to you know, keep bettering yourself from day to day. I think it's a very hard thing that you do, Ranveer. And one day I will sit and I'll ask you questions and to kind of be on all the time and to, you know, be constantly thinking of how this could be relevant to other people and kind of, you know, opening up yourself and living in an aquarium almost.
Yeah, dude.
Revealing your most vulnerable side. It's hard business, man.
It's exactly what you said. I never articulated it like that, but that aquarium feeling, I was just talking about it to my mom, to my friends, that you take pieces of your own self, your emotions, your mind, and just place it out there for the world. It's like you're cutting off chunks of your flesh and throwing it on the internet. So it
it's like you're exposing your underbelly all the time, right? You know, it's hard. You know, one of the things that I saw in the lockdown period, like I was saying that what is relevant? And I saw all these guys doing, you know, cooking at home and like really being very expressive and being very good. And I'm all thumbs when it comes to that. It just felt like, wow, this is so hard to do. It's you know, and now more than ever, I really realized that this is the future, right? The decentralization of media, the democratization of media, and you know, the decentralization of the power in the media is just boils down to you as a person, your connection to 100%. So many other people.
A friend of mine, Zakir Khan, who's a top comic in the country today, I was having this conversation with him.
Yeah.
What's that? Kuch Banda, no? What is it?
Sakht Londa.
Sakht Londa, yes. I love that guy, yeah.
He told me how he looks at this decade as the age of leaders, which is that personal brands, individuals who lead media houses, even say your normal FMCG brand like a toothpaste or hair oil, will be led by this one dude, like this one marketing genius. And often it will be someone who's capable of some form of creation. So whether that's writing, video creation, whatever. But this is going to be the age of leaders where it's going to be very kind of individualistic, which I think is exactly what you've unknowingly done over the last 20 years. Because when your name as Riaz Amlani's brand is associated with a restaurant, people have certain expectations of that place. So, have you ever thought of that? Though I know you're kind of a low-key guy, you're introverted, but I'm sure you had a moment in your life where you realize this shit is happening and you're like, okay, that's a little pressure, but then you dealt with it. So as a person, again, how do you go from, oh, fuck, I'm feeling too much pressure to, okay, you know what, I'll handle this?
Honestly, it's a little bit of schizophrenia, I think. you know, there's a part of you which is so cocksure, right? You know, you've made crores of investments. You've like, you've taken these big gambits, and you know, like, yeah, man, I'm Riaz Amlani, man. You know, if anybody can do it, it's me.
Yeah.
And then there's another part of you which is like, man, you think they like it? Do you really think they like it? Do you like the food? Do you like the way it looks? You know, tell me the truth. Tell me the truth. Do you like it? You know, and so I think there's this constant like duality, which again I think is good. I think is that, you know, every restaurant I open, I'm very, very nervous. I really am nervous until I actually walk in and I see it full. I'm so scared that this restaurant will be my undoing. This will be the restaurant that will say Riaz Amlani has lost the plot, you know. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think it is some degree of confidence and some degree of paranoia.
Yeah, dude. Self-doubt never leaves perfectionists, I think. It's the curse of being a perfectionist, where you'll always kind of have that little sense of, shit, it's not perfect enough.
Yeah, I used to have a lot of self-doubt before, but now I'm perfect.
Okay, so I've got to ask you the other burning question, which I haven't asked you yet. Which is that you mentioned Henry Ford. So are there like 3 to 5 entrepreneurs you can name that other entrepreneurs can pick up from in terms of lessons or that you've really kind of been inspired by or you've learned from by studying them?
So many. It's just too many. Like it's really hard to... I'm not a fanboy of any one particular entrepreneur, but there are bits of them that are worthy of admiration and, you know, the pioneering spirit that they actually brought, and they actually saw things, you know, which other people didn't see before. And I think that we all are kind of, in a sense, it's all about a relay race, right? You're always passing on the baton to somebody else because then somebody else, you know, in the future will do something, will build on something that you've built on, right? And I think it was, who said that we are standing on the shoulders of giants? I can see further because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. So I think we all kind of owe some tribute to people who've come before us, right?
Mm.
And I always find that true art is not about being completely original, but to actually funnel it through your prism, right? You take something that somebody else has built and then you kind of give your unique lens to it and then somebody else takes that and then builds something on with that, right? So there are, you know, I mean, it's all very different. I mean, restaurant, like I mentioned, my heroes in restauranting in India was Rahul Akirkar, Sanjay Narang, A.D. Singh. You know, these are the guys who came before me and were able to inspire me to build something because they built that and they showed that it works. And so I was able to add to that. So I think you have to hack your own heroes in that sense.
So, yeah. I know exactly what you mean, man. You were that person for me in my engineering college when I thought I'm going to become a restaurateur. But
dodged a bullet, buddy.
Why do you say that? I mean, because of this whole COVID situation.
I mean, look, you're in this COVID time and you're doing something which is really relevant and really important. And I am here twiddling my thumbs now. And
what do you think is the future of this industry? Because I think there's going to be a massive bounce back. But do you think the restaurant industry has changed forever? Is it going to become food delivery only? Like, what's going to happen?
No, of course not. I mean, the very DNA of the reason why we have a cerebral cortex is because we are social animals, and the reason that is the genesis of humanity is this need to be social, right? You could take that out of people, and they cease to be human. Mm. So no, it's not that it'll go away, but things will definitely change, right? Already you find that millennials, you going to restaurants is painful, you know. Gen Zs want to order food at home. They don't want to get out. They are part of the shutting out economy where they prefer to have fewer people in their homes and less outgoing. Mm. So you never know where this is going to land up, you know. But so it's hard to say. But for me, when I created Mocha, it was a coffee shop for the Gen Xers, which is people who are my age. I was born in 1974, right? So up to 86, I believe that's the Gen Xers. Then the social was a coffee shop for the millennials, in a sense. Mm. And already I feel that, you know, it could be outdated very soon. And I need to create something for the Gen Zs. And I think the important thing is to actually constantly be in touch with your audience and know what they want and give it to them in a way that they love.
Got it. And my last question for you, and this is because your kids kind of came into this phone call in the middle. Again, you know, that kind of separates the entrepreneur from you. It leaves you being the family man. Like, you can't show them the entrepreneurial side of yourself. You can't share your tensions entirely with your kids. So somewhere they're your motivation, somewhere they are like, you know, the reason you hustle for growth in your own life. I'm sure that's the case. They're part of you. And I'm sure that knowing you, knowing the kind of business acumen you have, you've taken really good care of your own personal finances. So one, could you elaborate on that whole equation about how your kids become your motivation? And two, can you give some personal finance advice in terms of, okay, even if your industry is really, you know, taking a hit now, how do you protect yourself as a man? And how do you protect your family?
I always think that I was a better restauranter when I didn't know anything about restauranting. because you didn't know that it couldn't be done. Or you didn't have set ideas of ye chalega or ye nahi chalega. As you grow in experience, you tend to take less risk. I've always maintained that experience is a terrible substitute for enthusiasm. Mm. So, you know, as we go along, I think, and when you have a family, you tend to be more responsible, of course. You take less risks. You tend to err on the side of caution all the time. You try to, you know, say, nah, I've got kids, I've got a family. Having said that, they also kind of they ground you in many ways and they make you realize what is really, really important. And you have, and then you realize that why families are so important and why, you know, the responsibility of making sure that your kids grow up to be good humans. So that, you know, the kind of stuff you were talking about earlier, the cyberbullying and saying bad things to people, you know, that does not happen. And you kind of, they kind of feel that they need to make the world a better place. And comes from within. And I think with children also, it kind of makes you want to be, set better examples and be a better person yourself, right? Because they are unforgiving in their criticism and they're so honest and refreshing. And even when, you know, I asked my son when this was happening, I said, you know, my business is suffering and what should I do? And he said, you should take care of your people first, Papa. And, you know, it was like, and I shared it on Instagram also. It was like, it was so inspiring, like this young kid giving me business advice. So, I'm a more risk averse businessman now because I have a family, but it's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. It adds some layers to you probably.
It does. It does. It does add some layers to you. It mellows you down a little bit.
And what about like the personal finance side of things? Like on a personal level, how have you like protected yourself over the years? Like in the mid 2000s when things started popping for you, what did you do with your money?
Well, you know, I mean, when it comes to money, it was always all in, right? It was whatever money we got, like I said, from day one, we always put it back into the business and we grew the business. Having said that, in hindsight, we were able to build a really solid business because we were all in. We didn't have a plan B, right? So failure was not an option. You know, success was the only way. We had to like sink or swim. I mean, that was it. So that's one school of thought. Now, there'll be another school of thought. They'll tell you should diversify. And, you know, the COVID is a very good example. Like everything that we built over the last 20 years, faces the very real risk of getting dismantled in a matter of months. So, you know, they would say that you should diversify and you should spread your money. But I think, you know, good, clever financial planning has never been my strength. So it's not something, my wife is actually a fantastic financial planner. But I think that, you know, just to have a diverse set of asset classes as you have some money. So a little bit in real estate, a little bit in stocks, a little bit in mutual funds, you know, a little indulgences here and there. But at the end of the day, you know, I think you have to remember to enjoy your life also, because that's also very important. And one of the things that I'm seeing about the newer generation is, you know, how they're not collecting things, but collecting experiences.
Mm.
And that's also, you know, amazing, because earlier it was all about your status symbols. And now it's more about where you've been and what you've done, which have become the new status symbols, right? It's not about the Gucci and the Prada anymore. And it's about going to, you know, unheard of places and doing crazy adventures. So things are changing. But I think as long as you enjoy your life, you know, and you have your facilities about you, and you eke out a living somehow or the other.
Beautiful. I want a signing off note, not for me, but for all the young restaurateurs who are, say, you know, you in your first 3 to 5 years who are suffering right now, people who are going to start restaurants and who are suffering right now. If you had to give them one piece of advice about the future of this industry, what would it be?
Well, you know, I'll say that don't get into the restaurant business because you think it is glamorous. Don't get into the restaurant business because you can, you know, make dal very well, you know. Be prepared that it's not a side business. It's going to take every ounce of you, like every inch of you, every ounce of you is going to demand it. It's a business where it is a passion project. Like you'll do it from a place of great passion. That's the only way of surviving it, because it's going to be very, very tough. You know, we got a lot of headwinds. Mortality rates in the restaurant business are very, very high. 90% of all restaurants don't make it past 5 years. And that's a true statistic. So, you know, get in, do it small. You know, start off really small. Perfect your craft. Make your mistakes. Make small mistakes so that you can live to fight another day. And just go for it, man. I mean, just go for it. Hammer and tongs. Do it your way. Don't do it any other way. Don't look over your shoulder. Don't look towards the west. Don't try and ye chal raha hai to main aisa hi karunga, you know, like social but different. No, I mean, do what really speaks to you, right? If you enjoy khichdi, then do a bloody khichdi. That's, you know, but make the best khichdi in the world. I mean, that's it. That's all I can say.
Beautiful, Mr. Riaz Amlani. I can't wait to go to a smokehouse deli with my mom again and just experience some of that gorgeousness. Thank you for the memories over the years. Thank you for this podcast. Again, I learn from everyone I meet, and I just ask you the questions I've wanted to ask you since college. So really appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Ranveer. I hope it was useful.